Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, Halloween Ends, Old Man, Stars at Noon, Rosaline, and a look back at other recent Halloween movies. I'll also be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Psycho 2. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's look really quickly at the box office from last week. Smile continued to be number one last week with $18.5 million. Now, I mean, you don't think that's much, but that was a drop of only 18%. First of all, most movies drop between 35 to 55% weekend to weekend. On top of it, horror movies tend to drop even quicker. But this thing only dropped 18%. I mean, it doggone nearly made what it made last weekend. That's fantastic. And it beat out Lyle Lyle Crocodile, which was a very soft number two, no pun intended, with 11.4 million. And pundits were expecting Lyle Lyle Crocodile to come in first because they're like, oh, there's no family movies out there. You know, because, you know, stuff like Sonic the Hedgehog did really well earlier this year. Amsterdam flopped. It came in third with $6.4 million, which was way less than what they needed. They're now estimating somewhere around the lines of, you know, like $100 million is what they might be losing on this film. And then what's real interesting is if you look down at the list of the box office receipts, Top Gun came in ninth place and just behind it. I mean, it almost was beaten by Terrifier 2. Now, first of all, Top Gun has been around forever. It's made over $700 million in the States alone. So, yeah, it's a huge hit, and it's still in the top 10 in October when it came out in May. But Terrifier 2, we talked about that last weekend. That's the little movie that could, again, great time for horror movies right now. Horror movies are doing very well in theaters, but Terrifier 2 was a phenomenal amount for such a small fringe movie. For a movie that's previous installment only played in a handful of cinemas, a Terrifier 2 making close to $1 million is actually pretty impressive. The next piece of news is one of those uncomfortable stories, and it's about Bill Murray, and he's been caught up. His Me Too story is this long, drawn-out thing. And it started out, he was working on this movie called Being Mortal that Aziz Ansari was directing, and it stalled. The production was shuttered because of an incident between Bill Murray and a crew member. No, there were not a whole lot of details came out. Well, eventually the details broke. And this has since been resolved. There's been a settlement and like involved like $100,000 he had to pay to this woman. But apparently, and he was wearing a mask. That's, I don't know if that's important, but he was wearing a, you know, a COVID mask. But he had apparently straddled her and kissed her. And he thought he was being playful and joking, but she took it as entirely sexual, and that caused a problem. Now, they've been trying to downplay this, and they do want to restart the movie because, I mean, money's on the line. So that's come back to haunt him. Plus the fact Gina Davis published her memoirs. And she has a couple weird little stories with him from the movie Quick Change, which was back in 1990. Where at one point she said that he was meeting her in a hotel room and he wanted to give her a massage, which first of all, look, I don't care who you are. Guys out there, if you ask a woman if you can give her a massage, it is always sexual. It is never not sexual. I mean, unless you are a masseuse and they're professionally paying you. But guys just don't give unattractive women massages. They just don't do that out of the niceness of their heart. It's a flirty thing. So don't act all like, oh, I thought I was being playful. My God, learn about this stuff. In 1990, Bill Murray should have known better. Now, the other thing I want to hit really quickly is I've talked at length about how I don't like to say there's too much content out there because I hate that complaint that people have. Too much content. I don't know what to watch because I love the fact that I'm in a position where I have so much stuff to watch. I don't need to worry about it. Gosh, do you remember what it was like when there were three channels and you'd cycle through and it would be like infomercials and old movies that were terrible? And you got three channels. It took you channel surf and you're done. You know what I mean? People don't know what it's like. You don't know what it was like when I was trying to explain to my son. I showed him Poltergeist and he didn't understand about TV channels going off the air at night. And I'm like, oh yeah, that happened. And sometimes you were left with one channel. That was the only thing broadcasting. But what's interesting is there is a danger of having too much content. And that is, if somebody gets bored with the series, they may not come back to it. And that's exactly what happened with me for both House of the Dragon and Rings of Power. I think Rings of Power looks very promising. It's beautiful. I just don't have the energy to watch it. And I even have less energy to watch House of the Dragon. I actually started watching like the third or fourth episode. And it's still sitting there in my queue, halfway watched, because I'm just like, I don't know. I don't have the energy to watch it. Same thing happened with Halo. I thought that was an interesting show, but it bogged down really quickly. And I thought, it's sort of like when you have a book and you get a couple chapters in and then you hit this slow part and you're just like, I'm just going to set that down and you never pick it up in the bathroom again. And the other thing is Andor, which is the Star Wars series, is getting dangerously close to that for me, because I know everyone's like, oh, it's an adult version of Star Wars. And they're pretentious about it because they're like, finally, Star Wars for the adults in the room. You stupid children. Quit fanboying everywhere. I'm watching Andor and not a whole lot's happening. And people are like, oh, but it's characterization. No, it's not. It's just a bunch of people sitting around in the woods. There was an episode of Andor that nothing happened in it. And I mean, I understand slow burns and all, but it doesn't make me want to hit next. So that's the danger, is you can lose your audience. And boy, when you lose your audience, they may just not come back to it. Why? Because there's so much other stuff out there to watch. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to touch on is Spirited, which is coming to theaters on November 11th and to Apple TV Plus on November 18th.
What is all of this?
I am your ghost of Christmas present.
Like a Christmas carol?
What do you think, I'm going to be all intrigued by what's behind the door?
Not even a little bit curious?
My first save?
There was this little sick kid.
What did they call him?
It was Tiny Tim.
No. Sweet kid, one crutch.
Nope.
Little Larry.
No, Tiny Tim.
Micro Mike. Super small Steve.
Holy.
Of course, coming out a week or two before Thanksgiving, it must be a Christmas movie. Yeah, Ryan Reynolds and Will Ferrell in a version of A Christmas Carol. And I think that looks fun. This looks fun. I mean, do we need another version of A Christmas Carol? I don't know. And I'm not a huge fan of musicals, but at least this looks like it might be, no pun intended, spirited for the holidays. It's a good thing we're going to watch it before Turkey Day. Anyways, the next one I want to hit really quickly is the Super Mario Brothers movie, which comes to theaters on April 7th.
I finally found it. Now who's going to stop me?
What is this place?
Do not touch that mushroom, you'll die! Oh, I'm sorry. That one's perfectly fine. Come on, Mario!
Mushroom Kingdom, here we come!
Now, the big buzz about this movie is Chris Pratt's voice. And I've talked to my sons about this, and they're big Mario fans. I mean, they grew up with this stuff, especially. I mean, I grew up with Donkey Kong. But I never grew up with the, like, Nintendo at home. They did. And they're huge fans of Mario, and they watch the cartoons and everything, and they love the voice cast of, you know, having, Seth Rogen do Donkey Kong and Jack Black do Bowser. Nobody's happy about Chris Pratt doing Mario. And there's actually a fan petition to get the original Mario back to do it. And part of it is because he just sounds like Chris Pratt. Although, you know what, I saw this on Twitter, I forget who said this, but they said it sounds like Chris Pratt is imitating Bradley Cooper doing Rocket Raccoon. Think about that, listen to the trailer again, and you'll never be able to unhear it.
Mushroom Kingdom, here we come.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Stars at Noon and Old Man.
We'll be right back.
and welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and start off with Stars at Noon. This is from A24, and A24 is a real interesting studio. I mean, I find that there's very few things that come out from A24 that I'm like, man, that was okay. Generally, it gives me a strong reaction one way or the other. I either really enjoy the movie or I just cannot stand it. Or if I really enjoy it, I may think that it's not the best movie, but there's some really interesting stuff in it. Every so many years, there's a new independent studio that has the most interesting, intriguing stuff. You know, a while ago, it was New Line Cinema. A while ago, it was Focus Features was at one point, like 20 years ago. Artisan was like that at one point. Now it's A24. You got Aparuna coming up too as one of these. And so Neon is another one that's kind of vying for the A24 slot. But A24 is known as sort of prestige stuff. It's art house stuff. So you end up with some polarizing movies. And that's what you're going to get with Stars at Noon. An American journalist is stuck in Venezuela during COVID and tries to escape with a shady British citizen.
Where are you from?
I'm an American journalist. I came here as a special correspondent. And what about you?
I'm here a lot. Should we meet again?
Again and again. Who's that friend of yours?
What I do interest.
He's waiting for you outside of the hotel right now.
Your British friend interests me. How long have you known him?
This is apparently based on a book that came out, I think it was in the early 80s, and it was during the Venezuelan Revolution, and so that's how it was framed, the book. And this is directed by Claire Denis. I think that's how you pronounce her last name. I've seen some of her films in the past, and she's very artistic. It's very, you know, it's very art house type style. So I knew that going in. And this thing played at Cannes and it like won a major award at Cannes, which is great. Good for them. The problem I had is if you listen to that trailer, it sounds way more exciting than the movie is. A good chunk of the movie is just watching the main character played by Margaret Qualley just kind of flop around Venezuela, trying to buy shampoo. I mean, I'm not lying with this one. And she's stranded there because she's an American journalist who apparently had written stuff that kind of offended the locals, and that's caused a problem for her to get a passport, and she can't get back to America. So she's constantly looking for an exit strategy. So she runs into this guy, and she kind of has this, and he's a young, attractive British guy who's there under nefarious circumstances. Nobody knows exactly what's going on. Nobody exactly knows why he's there. We never find out. But they have a little fling because at first she's kind of just sort of selling herself so she can get American dollars to buy a plane ticket. Because it's extraordinarily expensive, by the way, to fly from Venezuela. There's no direct flights. And she ends up falling in love with him. It's essentially a love story, which would be great if there was any chemistry at all between the two of them. Joe Alwyn, who I don't know who he is. I don't recall seeing him in anything else. He is so catastrophically boring in this movie that it's hard to watch. I mean, Margaret Qualley has a very, she's enticing on screen. She's attractive. She's got nuance to her performance. There are times when she plays it cute, and sometimes she plays quirky, and sometimes she plays very serious and at times troubled. I mean, she actually emotes and you have a connection. There's charisma that she has. And this guy has nothing. I mean, nothing at all. He is so boring. And between the fact that it's such a slow burn of finding out what her goals are, you know, it takes an hour for us to really find out what she's trying to do. And then you put her in with this guy and just she's given everything she can to him. And it's like trying to bounce a deflated basketball. It's just like, and every time it's supposed to be this dangerous love story. It's so boring. I mean, fans of drawn out, slow burn character dramas will enjoy this, but I found myself bored with the glacial pacing and the lack of chemistry between its stars. This is a movie that's not for your average person. I can see why it did very well at Cannes. I can see why, and that's not an insult. I mean, it's very much a French angled style of movie. It's very much about that sitting in the room with people doing very mundane tasks. And there's a lot of stuff you're supposed to build behind them, but it was just dull. And as much as I respect A24, I'm going to have to say that this movie sucked.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Old Man. This is directed by Lucky McKee. If you don't know who that is, he's a horror director. He's done a lot of more smaller stuff, fringe stuff. And the thing I remember about Lucky McKee is when his movie The Woman came out. When I got a screener for it, this is back when they sent physical screeners and they weren't just sending links. The internet hadn't gotten sophisticated enough yet. Along with the disc they sent a barf bag, which I thought was fabulous marketing. But anyways, Old Man, it's not as, it's the same, but it's very much got Lucky McKee's fingerprints all over it. Lucky McKee directs this intimate drama about a troubled man living alone in a cabin in the woods who encounters a lost hiker on his property.
I got lost in the woods. I saw smoke coming from the chimney.
How do I know you're not some damn psycho killer?
Do I look like a psycho killer to you?
Yes, you do. What if you come to find out that I'm very dangerous?
My grandfather told me you can never be too careful in these woods. He told me it's beautiful, but it can also be dangerous.
It's a very intimate movie. It's these two characters, mostly these two characters, in kind of this one-room cabin. I mean, everything's open. It's an open architecture concept cabin where everything from the kitchen to the outhouse is inside. And it's predictable. I mean, I could see where it was going. That's the thing. With a movie like this, the push of the movie, what it's trying to accomplish is, it's not obvious what it's trying to accomplish, but you definitely can recognize the path that they're taking. The things that are built in as surprises later on are not exactly surprises, but I can forgive that in a movie like this because things are so expertly done. And it stars Stephen Lang as the old man. And, you know, he carries most of the movie. He has most of the dialogue. The old man is in control of most of the situation, and his delivery and Stephen Lang's acting is extraordinarily good. And he is such a talent. Stephen Lang is. And I don't think he gets enough recognition. He's really good. He's what carries the movie. And it's nerve-wracking. It's also very compelling. You know, it's a movie about these two guys in a room, and it goes for an hour and a half. But you don't feel like it's an hour and a half. Whereas that last one, Stars at Noon, that thing felt like it was 14 hours long. This one was just two guys in a room, and it just breezed by. Even though it has, you know, certain things we've seen before and you can predict it and guess things. It was still a neat movie. I don't want to say too much about it because I don't want to give anything away. But, you know, ultimately, while it's not entirely original or predictable, this dark look inside a character's soul is held together with excellent acting by Stephen Lang. I'm going to say that Old Man kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to revisit Halloween and Halloween Kills before I talk about Halloween Ends.
This is Halloween. This is Halloween.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and look at Halloween. It's, of course, October, which means we get another Halloween movie. We've been getting these almost every October. We lose a couple years here and there. But for the last 40-some years, we've been getting Halloween movies. And I'm a huge fan of the franchise. I'm a huge fan of those 80s, the three key 80s slasher franchise being Friday the 13th, Halloween, and Nightmare on Elm Street. I love all three of them for different reasons. I will fully admit that Halloween is the one that goes off the rails the most and makes no sense a lot of times. At least most of Nightmare on Elm Street and a good chunk of Friday the 13th is all consistent within itself. But before I talk about the new one, let's just go back and I'm not going to review them again, but I just want to sort of refresh your memory about what was going on with the David Gordon Green Halloween trilogy. And we're going to start off with Halloween. This reboot of the classic franchise finds Michael Myers escaped from custody and on the run to attack Laurie Strode.
Michael Myers escaped.
He'll return to Haddonfield, his home.
I need to protect my family.
There's a reason we're supposed to be afraid of this night.
I've been preparing for this for a long time.
Get out of here! Get inside!
He's here.
After seeing all three movies, I kind of now realize what David Gordon Green was doing with this movie. He wasn't just making a sequel, and he wasn't just trying to revamp the original. He wanted to give you the full slasher experience in a modern version. He wanted to give you what people think the original 1978 Halloween was. But you forget, the original 1978 Halloween was not nearly as violent as this movie was. The original 1978 version, he kills three teenagers. He kills his sister in the first scene, and then he kills this driver after he escapes prison. But that's it. He kills three teenagers, which, I mean, not to sideline death like that, but it's hardly a high body count movie. It's about suspense. But most people remember it as, in that sort of Mandela effect, they remember the movie as just Michael Myers just slicing through town. And that's really what happens in this first David Gordon Green Halloween. He gives you the Halloween movie you wanted. He gives you the Halloween movie where it's the mass killer up against the final girl, and it is all about just him hacking and slashing. And that works, and that because that's what people expect. Now, fast forward a couple years through COVID, and you get to Halloween Kills. Serving as a bridge to the finale of the new trilogy, this film focuses on the town of Haddonfield and the other survivors of Michael Myers' 1978 massacre.
40 years ago, the boogeyman came for us. We are the survivors of Michael Myers.
Lori, what do we do?
We fight.
Mom.
Our family
will kill him.
We're going to hunt him down and we're going to put an end to this.
Halloween Kills was very polarizing. There are some people who hated it. I mean, just like hated it. And it didn't get a great Rotten Tomatoes score. It doesn't get a great audience score. And I think part of it is people didn't see what he was trying to do. The first movie gave you the slasher film, and this one still had all the kills going through it. But where the first movie was about the final girl, it was about Laurie Strode and her family, Halloween Kills was about all these other secondary and tertiary characters. I mean, you had Tommy Doyle and Lindsay Wallace, who were the kids that they were babysitting for. You have the father of one of the girls, who was also the sheriff at the time. They actually bring the actor back from that one. You even have Lonnie, who is this kid who had the very minor just as a bully against Tommy in the original movie. But I like that that focused on it because it was focusing on the effect that Michael Myers in these murders had on the town and had on the other people. We know what it did to Laurie Strode. And we got that all through pretty much any time Jamie Lee Curtis has appeared in the franchise, we get how traumatic that was for her. But I thought it was neat to explore what it was like for the kids who were being babysat for in the movie, how that affected them and what happened to them as they went on in life. I think that was actually kind of cool. And I liked what it said about mob rule and about mob mentality and about, you know, sort of that mob justice and how things can get ramped up and how one person can really ramp things up. And how it doesn't matter what the truth is, it's whoever's yelling the loudest. I mean, I think there were some really interesting things buried in there. It just wasn't the Halloween movie everybody expected. Well, that leaves us out of Halloween Kills, and we have another new one out. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Halloween Ends. 4 years after Michael Myers escaped and massacred more people in Haddonfield, he is missing and new killings start happening.
I was certain that I saw him watching me.
You pretend like you moved on, but you're actually just obsessed with death.
What are you gonna do when Michael comes back for you? Because he is coming.
But this time, something feels different. He's more dangerous.
It all ends.
ends now.
You came here to kill me, so do it.
I didn't watch the trailers for this before I saw it, and I'm glad I didn't, because the trailers are very spoilery. I had heard that, and so I avoided watching the trailers. And I went and saw this completely cold. I didn't even know it took place 4 years later. And I realized as I'm watching the movie what David Gordon Green is doing. Just as Halloween 2018 was about Laurie Strode, and Halloween Kills was about the town and the other people who encountered Michael Myers in 1978, Halloween Ends completes the trilogy of a love letter to the Halloween franchise. And when I say it's a love letter to the franchise, it is not just a love letter to the original 1978 classic. It's a love letter to the whole thing. Starting from the fact that the title, the font they use on the title, is the font from Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which has nothing to do with Michael Myers. That's a little nod that David Gordon Green did, saying, hey, this is the third movie, and I'm paying tribute to this movie that everyone hated when it first came out, and now think is pretty good. And there's all these elements in there where it's really paying tribute to the sequels of Halloween. And if you know anything about the sequels, I've watched every Halloween movie. And I actually went to a friend's house once and we watched all of them in a row, which is rough. And all those movies, those sequels are all over the place. And they really just sometimes go out way into left field and beyond left field. That's the real curse of Michael Myers, is you can't carry the Halloween story the way you can the Jason Voorhees story, which doesn't change that much aside from the fact that at one point it's not Jason Voorhees in like part 5, and then it turns into zombie Jason. But there's really, they're pretty straightforward. Friday the 13th. The Halloween franchise goes off the rails very quickly, multiple times. I mean, Rob Zombie did it in the second movie. And even then, I think David Gordon Green is giving a tribute in some ways to Rob Zombie. He's saying, hey, look, I may not like all the films equally, but I respect the fact that everybody's tried these things. And that's what Halloween Ends is about. It's about the sequels. It's about when the legend becomes so big, you can't contain it. And there's a lot of these like weird little elements, these little nods and homages to other old horror movies, everything from Salem's Lot to the original Psycho. You got to have a really strong knowledge of horror cinema and horror, and it's just in general, to really fully catch a lot of this stuff. But the people who want the big slasher movie, I mean, if you want the slice and dice, Michael Myers walking through gutting people like you did in the first movie or even the second one here, you're not going to get that. When I say first movie, I mean 2018. This is more about the legend that it becomes. And the movie is a meta examination of itself. And that's kind of part of what I liked about it. I thought it was something different. I mean, it ran a bunch of these storylines that we'd seen before in the other Halloween movies, but it worked. I mean, this will be polarizing for fans, but there are some real clever elements for David Gordon Green's final Halloween film. I'm going to say it was different enough that it kept my attention and I enjoyed it. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Rosaline and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Psycho 2. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the final one, which is Rosaline. This is available on Hulu. It's not in theaters. It's one of those that they've pivoted to Hulu. And that's probably not a bad idea. We'll talk about that in a second. But first, the classic story of Romeo and Juliet is retold from the perspective of Juliet's cousin, Rosaline, who is also Romeo's ex.
The greatest love story ever told.
Romeo.
Sweet Juliet.
Was missing a chapter. Mine.
You don't understand.
They were
being all gross, and he was saying things to her that he just said to me.
Mm.
3 days ago.
Yes.
Three, nurse. I got this feeling on the summer
day when you were gone. So
you gonna break them up?
Of course I am. Romeo and Juliet. Doesn't even sound right.
You want my help with this?
We just need to stop a wedding. My boyfriend is about to make the biggest mistake of his life.
It's not uncommon to see these types of stories where this is one step out of this twisted fairy tale. We've seen the things where, you know, Wicked is a great example, you know, the Broadway show Wicked, where it's told from the villain's point of view. Same thing that happened with the Maleficent movies that Disney did. And this is based on a book. I've not read the book, so I don't know anything about it, but it definitely feels like it's teen literature, tween and teen literature. It's rated PG-13. It has a little bit of, let's just say, raunchy language in there that is going to offend maybe my mom, and that's about it. I mean, it's really not that bad. But it's a take off of Romeo and Juliet, and already it deliberately puts in a bunch of anachronisms. And I'm okay with that. I've gotten tired of the let's just make puns about the medieval times, because, you know, they did that with the Shrek movies, and they did that with Ellen Enchanted, and they did that with what was that one with the, you know, hoodwinked with the fairy tale creatures. At least they're not doing the twisted fairy tale thing again. And they still make it basically take place in the Renaissance era, but it's, you know, they don't have, you know, modern devices. But it does have, the one thing that bothers me about it, and I'll just get this out of the way. I get tired of having to go through the motions of anytime you have a story like this. It's not that I disagree with this message or this characterization. I just get tired of hearing it because it opens up every movie where the character is like, oh, I'm a woman in the medieval times and I wish I could do whatever I want to, marry whoever I want to, go exploring, own property, blah, 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 blah. And I get that. I understand. I'm not at all taking issue with that messaging. I just get tired of hearing it because it's like, okay, let's get through this. Cause, you know, I've heard this speech 1,000 times in movies, and now it's getting ridiculous. Cause there was another movie I saw this week. Cause a friend of mine wanted to do a spot on his radio program about it, was the Lena Dunham film, Catherine Called Birdie, which is on Prime. And her character is like, and she's all upset because she can't do whatever she wants to do. But they're, of course, they're privileged and they have money. So, I mean, you're not at want of anything. You just are, you're sort of shackled by your station, which everybody was at that time. And I just get so tired. And so I saw two movies where they talk about that. And it reminds me of like when they did the movie Aladdin. The original cartoon was nice, and Jasmine's big push was, I want to marry whoever I want to marry. Now, it doesn't have to be a prince. And that's a common theme in the Disney movies, going back to Sleeping Beauty. But then in the remake of Aladdin, they suddenly were like, oh, I want to be Sultan too. And I'm like, now wait, hold on a second. First of all, why is that important to the story? It's not. And second of all, I understand, yes, you know, women can do whatever they want to do, but, you know, you're talking about, whatever, 12th century Persia, that's not how it worked back then. It just wasn't. So, you know, it just feels like it's bending over backwards to be progressive for, you know, the viewers today. And so there's a little bit of that in Rosalie, but very quickly they get past that and then they move on with just her as, sort of this upstart character, and Caitlin Dever plays her and she does a great job. It's her spunkiness and it's her attitude and her charisma on screen that really carries the movie. Because she is upset at this, but it's not her whinging on for 2 hours about how she wishes she could go explore the world because she wants to not be shackled by the era. It's her then trying to scheme to cause problems for Romeo and Juliet. Of course, you should fast forward to the end of the script and find out what happens to Romeo and Juliet. But that's another story, and, you know, it's dealt with there. It's a cute enough movie. I think she's the reason the film works. And there's some other good performances in there. I mean, you got like, like Bradley Whitford plays her father and he's really good, and Christopher McDonald's in and he's very good. So there are some good performances, but ultimately, you know, Caitlin Dever holds together this whimsical tale that often threatens to collapse under cliche, but it just manages to survive and tell a cute, fun tale. I'm going to say that Rosaline kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on an older movie. It's something I swerved into. It's what I've been watching this week. And that is Psycho 2. After decades in a mental institution, Norman Bates is released but soon faces haunting memories from his past as he reopens his infamous motel.
Norman Bates is judged, restored to sanity, and is ordered released forthwith.
It's 22 years later, and Norman Bates is coming home.
I own a motel not too far from here, and you'd be welcome to spend the night in one of the empty rooms if you'd like.
Good night, Mary.
Who is this? My mother is dead.
I remember this was one of the first horror movies I actually got to see, R-rated horror movies I got to see in the theater. It came out in 1983, I think. Now, you can see this. I believe it's on HBO Max, along with Psycho 3, which isn't nearly as good. But if you want to watch the original Psycho, you can find that on Peacock. So the stuff's out there. You're just going to have multiple services. Anyway, Psycho 2, I did watch the Riff Trax version of it. I wanted to watch a Riff Trax, and I bought this Riff Trax of Psycho 2 a while back. And I said, oh, let me go ahead and watch it. And I remember seeing it when I was like 12. And, you know, I liked it because your benchmark's a little lower when you're 12. And I had seen Psycho. My dad had shown me the original Psycho, and I loved the original Psycho. Great movie, and it still is. Psycho 2, though, does kind of fall into a slasher film. It's this weird tightrope walk because in a lot of ways, Psycho 2 works. And a lot of that is because of Anthony Perkins. He does such a good job as Norman Bates. And after 20 years of the history of Psycho, everybody knew who he was, and he was typecast as Norman Bates. So then he decided to go all in and play him again. And he really adds some pathos to him. He does a great job acting. You really feel for this guy, even if you're aware that he's clinging to sanity. And you really feel sorry for him. It's got Meg Tilly in a relatively early role of hers. She plays this woman that he meets at a diner that he works at. She ends up staying in the motel, or I think she ends up staying in the house with him. But of course, that brings up all the worries about Mother coming back, because Mother was worried about him having a relationship with women. But it also has Vera Miles from the original Psycho. She reprises her role as Janet Leigh's sister. And I like that. I like the fact they got some of the original people from the original movie, and it made it work. It made it feel authentic. And I got to say, this is a much better Psycho than the remake of Psycho that they did in, 1996, 1998 with Gus Van Sant. So it's elevated a bit above just a slasher film. I mean, it came out in 1983, and they were trying to just mine whatever they could to make money while Friday the 13th and Halloween and, well, Nightmare on Elm Street hadn't started by then. But there are a billion other slasher movies, Prom Night, Alone in the Dark, all these different movies that had come out in the late 70s, early 80s. So they were going for old tried and true properties. So they brought out Psycho 2, but they don't delve completely into slasherism. Because again, the original Psycho, he only kills like two people, I think. Something. I mean, there's not a whole lot of on-screen death in that movie. This one has a little bit more. But it does have some interesting twists and guesses, and I remember enjoying it as a kid and being impressed as a kid, and watching it again decades later, I realize it's still imperfect, but I was impressed by it. I mean, it's an obvious cash grab, and it was an attempt to capitalize on the slasher craze of the early 80s, but a strong performance by Anthony Perkins and some clever twists helped this rise above the run-of-the-mill sequel fodder. I'm going to say that Psycho 2, and I'm going to give it a rocks because I saw it when I was a kid, and I have memories of that, and that, of course, makes it feel better than it probably really is. But still, I would not give this a negative rating either way. I'm going to say Psycho 2 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the show. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Black Adam and the Banshees of Inisherin. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.